I honestly think psychologically there's a bit of a mess there, and I think it comes from before what we're talking about with Real Madrid.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
The Sunday Papers
on Off the Ball.
Now I'm very happy to say that I am joined by Cliona Foley and Jesse Barr to look through today's papers. Guys, you're very welcome. How are we doing?
We're all croaking. Well, two of us are croaking.
We're a little bit sick in the studio this morning, but it's all right. We'll make it through.
I'm the healthy one.
You're the healthy one. Unsurprisingly, that the former athlete would be the healthiest person in the room.
Former being the operative word.
Cliona, you said to me earlier to ask you when was the last time that yourself and Jesse had met up?
Yeah, because we're going to be queens of smugness now this morning. But the last time we met was at the Paris Olympics.
Yeah.
Am I right?
Yeah, we were trying to figure out what sport we were watching. But I think we figured out it was at badminton, waiting for either pre or post Nats, one of his first matches.
Yeah, so, that's right. Yeah, amazing arena.
Amazing arena. I was very fortunate to be there with a media pass, so I was getting lots of really cool access. And it's always nice to bump into a familiar face when you're out there. So, yeah, very smug. Yeah, well, I'm very, very
I'm
jealous.
Sorry.
I think I'm
sorry.
Probably
apologies.
One of the only people in the entire country who didn't get over to the Olympics in some shape or form. So, we're off to a great start. I don't hate the two of you at all.
It wasn't that good.
Yeah, yeah. That's what everyone seems to have been saying.
Yeah, it wasn't the best Olympics ever.
No,
or most successful. No.
It was terrible.
And Jess obviously was working as a sports psychologist when I was working for the Olympic Federation on their media side.
Yeah.
But it was funny, like we were both, you were there obviously working as an athlete's psychologist, and I was looking at it from the media point of view. It's always really interesting to meet people in those roles, and actually you're still both totally engrossed in the thing as well.
100%.
And it was fantastic.
Yeah, definitely. I'm trying to do a double job of covering media side for athletics, but then doing the day job as well. So it was interesting to see that you were involved in so many different roles as well. Everyone seems to be out there just doing everything. How did you find the balance of that if you are that close to athletes and talking to them on that level and then also having to go out and talk to the public about the athletes?
I had to do a lot of prep in advance to make sure I kind of knew what that balance looked like. So I spoke to every athlete that I worked with to make sure they were okay with the fact that I was going to be in a media side. Most of the athletes, I work with a handful in athletics, but not that many. So there wasn't many that I had the conflict of talking about athletes who I work with currently. It was a lot of prep work to make sure I kind of knew what was okay to talk about, what were the boundaries, and set those boundaries really clearly. But when it came to it, actually in athletics, I was mainly covering radio coverage. So it was very much talking about what was going on, and it wasn't just from the Irish perspective. So that made it easier. Mm. So I was able to kind of just, it was kind of giving an insight into the public. And I suppose being a sports psychologist, being a former athlete, that had the interest, but I wasn't going out there saying, well, this is what so-and-so is feeling at this stage, because I can't say that either.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely an interesting balance to strike, but I hope I did okay.
Well, it's an interesting one to start with, considering some of the pieces that are in the paper today, because there is quite a lot about athletes and how they work with coaches and how they work within the Irish system. And there's a really good piece with Sunita Prosper, Sinead Kassan has that one, and talking about her, talking about her experience of Irish rowing and her experience with coach, and I suppose where her journey as an athlete, where she feels like it didn't go all that well for her, I suppose, in the last couple of years.
Yeah.
And the fact that her retirement, it really flew under the radar over the last year. I don't think people really made a mark of it at all, considering the amazing success that she's had.
Yeah, and we were just saying it's actually interesting and great on the day that it is, when you're concentrating so much on women's sport today, that two or three of the really interesting pieces in the Sunday papers today are with and about female athletes. And this is one of them. Sinead really has an exclusive here. I think it's the first time Sunita Prosper has spoken about her experience in the High Performance Irish Rowing Centre in the last few years, and where and why she struggled so much. She didn't make the team for Paris, and she goes through a lot of the reasons, her frustration at not making that team. And, you know, memorably, she went to Lucerne last May, and she had to just, she was in a single sculls, and people might remember that. And she's very open about it here. She says that she thought before the race that only something stupid would prevent her from qualifying from Paris. And then that's what I did. I did something stupid. She caught a boy, and she was flying through the race. She went out too fast.
She absolutely,
in the last 500 metres, she absolutely died. And I was like, oh my God, what are you doing? Such an experienced rower. But she definitely would have had issues with the high performance director, Mario Giovanna. And she talked, Giovanni, who has since been let go, and she talks quite openly here about why that was. She felt he was upping her load, training load far too much, and that it just really rendered her very just exhausted and not able for stuff. And he was saying he felt that it, mentally she wasn't strong enough, and she was saying it's not mental, it's a physical thing. And so it goes into real detail on really, I suppose, the pull and push and pull that occurred there. He was let go after the Olympics, and it kind of again went a bit, you know, everyone sees Irish rowing as such a successful environment at the moment. And when he was let go, people went, oh, you know, what does that mean? And why did that happen? And obviously Irish rowing, Sinead has talked to Irish rowing here as well. And they've said three of the approximately 150 athletes who are part of the Irish performance of the high performance pathway have raised issues since, and they're saying they're very small. But as somebody who works as a sports psychologist, Jesse will know, it doesn't matter how small they are, mm-hmm. They still need to be addressed. And in the case of Sunita, who was, you know, a world champion and really was the, particularly for, on the women's side, really was the groundbreaker for her. She was the only rower of any gender that we had in London, if I remember correctly. Yeah. So she was part of leading the high performance thing. And so it's a very interesting interview, I think. He didn't do an awful lot of press, Mario Giovanni, but he did a press event last year before the Olympics, and it always struck me how very dogmatic he was, because he said, I always remember the quote, he said, you know, volleyball and football and athletics, these are sports, but rowing is a discipline. And he was a very, you know, strong-minded, and he really pushed. Obviously, Irish rowing at that stage had to jump from the lightweights to developing more heavyweights, because that's where the sport is going internationally, and particularly in the Olympics, the lightweights are being phased out. But in this, she talks about how, like, he pushed in her sense. In the early years, she said her weekly mileage was between 160, 190 km, with 20 kilometres, the longest in a single session. But last year, she says, the programme increased to a weekly 220 to 240, and 32 kilometres was the bread and butter. And that was only the morning session. Mm. So if people wonder how has Irish rowing become so successful, you know, that's the reason as well. They really push them hard and hard and hard in training. And so it's a very interesting piece. I think it's well worth a read.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's brilliant. And I think, you know, when you look at some of the very specific details of what she experienced, you know, she says she was burnt out. She said that her resting heart rate before Tokyo was in the 70s compared to her standard 55, 56. She went to a psychologist who told her that she was suffering from depression around the time that she was thinking of retiring, before she actually did retire, and they advised her not to because they thought that the equivalent of retiring and everything she was going through, it would just be too much to take in one go.
Yeah.
She talks about saying that she was tired, and people saying, you know, you're fine, you're a bit tired now, but you'll get over it. But knowing herself that it was a different sort of tiredness.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that there wasn't, I suppose, people there to listen to her about how she was feeling and trusting that she knows her own body.
Yeah. And look, I suppose I can't speak too much on it. I don't work with rowing, and, you know, given my work in Sport Ireland, I do have to be very mindful that there are people who are still involved in everything that's going on. But I know there's been just a lot of challenges over the years, and I think there is people to listen in the system, but their voices maybe aren't getting heard the same way as maybe someone who is more dominant, like an Antonio, who's, you know, now stepped back. And, you know, that could be a change for the good for the next generation. But yeah, when you have such big personalities, sometimes the people who are the supports maybe aren't the ones, the voices that are getting heard. Like that idea, and I always laugh at that idea when someone says, oh, they weren't mentally tough enough. Someone like Sunita, if I was, you know, you nearly, from what I know, I don't know Sunita well, but, you really have to question, well, what was his definition of mental toughness? Because, you know, this is a woman who is a two or three children, came back to rowing, was, you know, put everything on the line for
won a world championship.
Won
after
a world
her
championship.
Sister died of cancer for
yeah. You know, I mean, if yeah. that's Alan, you know, if that's not what mentally tough is, I don't know who is mentally tough or what was it he was actually looking for. So, yeah, I suppose when you hear comments like that being made by someone like her, you kind of say, well, if she's not mentally tough, who is? You know, yeah. what's the expectation? And was there an impossible standard that she couldn't meet? But yeah, look, it's every sport has their challenges. And look, for an athlete like Sunita, it's just a shame that this is kind of what's the end of her career is now going to, I suppose, be tied up with stories like this rather than the reflection on how much she did, being the kind of, I suppose, that person who put rowing on the map in Ireland, the reason that we kind of now have the system that we do, and especially in women's sport, was such a kind of a flag bearer for us. So it's a shame that now we're talking about her in her retirement tied up with stories like this. But
and to give some balance, like in the piece, you know, it says there were obviously rowers in the system who wanted Mari Giovanni to be kept on, and Ross Corrigan won the Olympic finals, you know, stressed that and came out at the time and saying, you know, it was a pity he wasn't kept on. But from her point of view, she wasn't happy with him. And she's also saying that her own daughter, who's 17 and is a good young rower, she's saying that she isn't so sure that she would want her to be part of this programme. Mm. She feels it was very, very tough.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And it's not the first time that she has raised things. You know, it should be said that a lot of the complaints she had were raised internally within the organisation. This isn't her kind of coming out and trying to make a big deal of something without having tried to solve it from the inside first as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, as you're saying, Jesse, it is a real pity that this is the way we're talking about her and talking about her story rather than giving her the flowers that she deserves for an incredible career. And yeah, as you say, even beyond rowing. And I think like rowing is one of those really interesting sports because the people who go into rowing, they're so focused and driven in every aspect of their life. And, you know, you see so many of them, even the careers that they have outside rowing, you know, they're doctors. And you're like, where do you fit the time in to be a
high
doctor?
Achievers.
Yeah, exactly. They're very much high achievers. So that mentality and questioning that mentality, that was one of the bits that I found really interesting in the piece, because I just can't imagine anyone who can have the sort of success that she has had in her career. But I suppose when it comes to coaching as well, it's different people react to different things. You know, some people need the softer hand or a different sort of encouragement. And I'm sure you see plenty of that in your 100%. Line of work.
You know, sometimes it can come down to just personality mismatches. You know, a coach at the end of the day is just a person as well. And they have a belief about how things should be. There's going to be athletes who will have beliefs about how things should be. And each athlete in that system probably had different things that they needed that brought out the best in them. And yeah, that's where something like that gets really challenging, where you have people who really buy into the system and it really works for them, and others who it doesn't. So, you know, it's hard to say. It's just like, I suppose, just bringing the focus back to Sunita that, yeah, do you want every athlete to walk away from their career looking back positively, and not through rose-tinted glasses, but looking back that it was a rose-tinted career, and it just doesn't happen that way. And I think when you come to the end, you maybe do reflect on the things that didn't go so well, and it can be very easy to then for that to be overlooked by herself as well. So I just hope she's able to kind of enjoy her retirement and kind of make the most of it, because I know there is supports there for her. I just hope she is, you know, getting those supports and, yeah, able to just move into whatever her next phase is.
And it's also fair to say as well that all of this happens against a time, in a time when Ireland women won their first Olympic rowing medal in the four. You know what I mean? So, and I think they were disappointed and felt they underachieved in Paris, but in Tokyo they certainly didn't. And, you know, there was a big breakthrough, and there is a big community now of high performance women rowing in Ireland. So all of that happened at the same time as well, you know. So there are always different sides to every argument. But
absolutely,
it's certainly well done. And Sinead, you know, it's a very good piece, Sinead Cassan in the Cinda. And it's the first time, as I said, I've seen her talk as openly about what happened.
Yeah, no, it's a brilliant piece and definitely worth picking up. And as you said, Lena, there's a lot of good pieces with women in the papers today. Lisa O'Neill as well.
In
the Mail. Really interesting piece with her. And again, another sport where we've seen women like your Rachel Blackmore's, mm-hmm. even the likes of Jane Mangan, who's yeah. everywhere at the
yeah,
moment,
brilliant as well, yeah.
coming through and just kind of dominating the conversation, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, just as I said on the you know, the Nollaig na Mban, the special celebration of women in sport. Like, it's interesting, the Mail on Sunday has a female sports editor in Orla McElroy, who's often been in here, and they do, you know, sometimes just and head they actually there's a link on this that says it's a women in sport piece. But very often it doesn't have to be labelled that. And I often think that the media doesn't look for stories as much as they should sometimes amongst female athletes. But this one is a great one. Lisa O'Neill, for people who don't know her, I mean, obviously she won a big race in Cheltenham, I think it was 2017, on Tiger Roll, the famous National Hunt Chase, which is really, fans love that race. It's one of the big races to win. But she's now a race rider. So she's a work rider for Gordon Elliott. So she rides out in the morning at the usual unimaginable times for us normal people.
First ride out's at 7:15 in the morning.
7 in the morning. They run. They ride lots. It's amazing to watch. So she's primarily doing that now and TV analysis. And along with people like Jane Mangan, she's become a really good race analyst and she's brilliant to listen to. They were both obviously working at Leopardstown at Christmas and just really fantastic insights. But, and I didn't know this, she qualified with a master's in sports psychology in the last year and she worked with the Mayo footballers, men's footballers, which I didn't know either. Mm. So Philip Lanigan has written this piece. It's a really interesting piece. And it's really interesting as well about what she's saying is, like, she's working with different athletes at the moment and she's working in team sport. She's worked at GAA. But actually, she also is really interested in the bigger use and the greater use of sports psychology in racing and amongst jockeys, which I think is increasing. Mm. But it is interesting that she would have a particular insight into their lifestyle and, like, what a tough life, particularly jump jockeys lead. And,
yeah.
you know, everything, your day revolves, as she says, and is the old cliche, with an ambulance following you around at your work. But it's such a precarious job that I imagine psychologically it's a huge test because you're up, you're down. If you're a journey woman jockey, you're not getting the opportunity on the big rides. Then one big ride propels you, as it has with Rachel Blackmore, you know, into all these opportunities where you can show how brilliant you are. But I just think male or female, it's a really difficult sport psychologically. So it's very interesting to see that she's going into that area of it as well.
Yeah, it's great to see. And it makes sense when I was reading it because, you know, I was reading this morning and it said that she qualified out of Setu, formerly WIT, and Kira Losty, who I would work with at Sport Ireland, would probably have been, you know, at least one of her tutors. Yeah. She leads that program. And she has a direct link with the Irish Jockeys Association. Yeah, I'm not sure the exact title.
Yeah.
But they've done a lot of research around mental health in jockeys and around the stigma around talking about mental health. So even for someone to kind of be taking that role and kind of seeing, you know, someone coming from the inside to be a psychologist, I think she's in the perfect place to do it, because I'm sure, like, a lot of the findings that Kira and I'm sure Lisa was probably involved as well, the research was that there's huge stigma towards mental health help seeking, which would probably, you know, be the umbrella of sports or sports psychology, probably fall under the umbrella of help seeking. That, and she mentions it here, that it's seen as a weakness, you know, if you're talking about the mental side, if you're talking about the emotional side of things, is probably seen as weak, and you don't want to be weak when you're getting on a horse and you're going to be riding at those kind of speeds. But yeah, so there has still been a big barrier for people seeking help. So I think she's probably best placed because she's been there and done that. Mm. And I think there is, and look, I can see it in my own career, there's a lot to be said for being able to kind of, I suppose, talk the talk and having walk the walk as well for some athletes who are still quite resistant. But for her to be working with Mayo is an incredible opportunity on the other side of things. I mean, she really has established herself in two really difficult areas. I mean, if you can, you know, if you can work as a sports psychology consultant in GAA in a team like Mayo and work in horse riding, I mean, she's taken on two really difficult areas. And, you know, I'm excited to see how she gets on. I'd love to actually meet her because I haven't come across her before, but I'm sure we'll cross paths at some point. Yeah, because it's a challenging one, but if she knows it, it probably doesn't seem as challenging.
Yeah, know? Yeah, yeah, exactly.
She knows what it's like.
But I like, even, you know, every jockey's autobiography that comes out, you get into, like, Davy Russell's, you know, like, they they exude this hard persona and they have to be physically so hard.
Yeah.
But it's their mental strength that is phenomenal, I think. You know, the ability to fall, get back up on a horse in the next race.
And it's not one that they talk about
they
all that much,
no.
Especially when they're in their career. Sometimes they'll reflect on it after the fact, but very rarely do you ever hear jockeys talk about it in the moment.
Yeah.
And I wonder, is that a thing of like, you almost can't let yourself think about it or talk about it because it might be too tough?
As well, I know with athletes often as well, like even in terms of them qualifying for grants, or in this case in professional sport, being employed, you know, you don't want to appear vulnerable at any stage. So as you say, it very often comes out after they've retired. Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it?
There's like a safety net. I can talk about it. And, you know, if you're to read any of the research that's coming out about it now, there is that fear of what the repercussions would be if I kind of show that weakness. Like if I say I'm nervous about getting back on after that major injury or that major fall that I had, they're probably not going to select you because they think, well, you're not going to be the right person for the job. And you see that in team sports. You see that as a fear, you know, coaches, who's making decisions, who's the manager that's making the decision. If I am vulnerable and open, does that then put kind of like a black mark against my name for when future selections are being made? And it's a shame because being vulnerable doesn't have to go hand in hand with poor performance. Actually, sometimes it can be the opposite. It can actually increase good performance because you're accepting where those weaknesses are, but looking for the help to make them better. But yeah, I think, you know, horse racing is probably still the last one to kind of come around to that. And I think it's great that there is someone from within who's kind of making those changes.
Yeah. And it's interesting, she was saying, I think that's one of the aspects as well for her to work in a team sport. Like she said, she was technically part of a team of people even who were working on the mental side with Mayo footballers. And she was technically employed as a mental skills coach. But I'd say that the involvement on the team element, which is something that you don't necessarily get in the way room, you know what I mean?
Mm.
No matter how great friends they are, and I interviewed Rachel Blackmore just before Christmas for a piece of the Examiner, which is coming out next week, I think. They're still in competition with each other all the time. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? For the rides.
Yeah.
So there's a sisterhood and a brotherhood within the way room, but I think it's a very different kind of one that you would get in a team sport. So I'd say she would have learned a lot working with the team and just starting to get that insight. But I knew somebody had started doing a lot of work on the mental side with the injured, I'm not sure, is it through the Injured Jockeys Fund, but definitely through Racing Ireland, and it is Ciara Clastan, right? I'd forgotten who it was. So I think Horse Racing Ireland now are even putting stuff in place to support jockeys psychologically that wouldn't have been there before.
Yeah.
Because it is such a tough sport.
Oh.
And the fact that this hasn't been in place before, or that people haven't maybe been researching it as much as it is now, it does just make you wonder how those people have kept going through the years and how they have been able to, you know, get back up or even just live with the uncertainty of not knowing, you know, if you're going to get another ride or if a trainer is going to like you or even if a horse is going to like you as well and developing those relationships and even the aspect of like the animals themselves developing that closeness to them but knowing that one wrong move from you in a race and all of a sudden that animal doesn't exist anymore. You know, it's such a tumultuous career.
Tumultuous is a great word.
To go down. And even the weight aspect of it as well. Like
any sport that has a weight aspect is huge psychologically as well. Kelly Arrington could talk for months on that subject alone. So like it's testing you psychologically all the time. And it was funny with Rachel Blackmore, I was saying to her, like, what are your plans for 2025? She said, well, she had a really bad neck injury. She sat out 12 weeks, 3 months, and she just got back racing before Christmas. She said, I actually can't plan too far ahead because, she said, if you start to do that, suddenly you get an injury and you're out for 12 weeks and everything's different.
Yeah.
So it's difficult psychologically in every way, I think, to a lot of sports and very challenging for them.
And as well, you don't have that same team aspect as you were saying, you know.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's a benefit, sometimes it's harder, you know, if you're seeing your whole team out training and you're not able to, I know, talked to Jamie Finn quite a lot about it. She's obviously coming back from an ACL injury and she's been doing a lot of solo training to get herself back on the pitch. And she went over to Birmingham and I was like, what was the experience? You know, did you enjoy seeing everyone training? And she was like, part of me did and the other part of me just wanted to be on the pitch. And there are days where it was easier to do everything by yourself and there are days where you just needed someone to lift you up as well.
And it just shows you how individual people are psychologically as well.
Yeah.
Whereas some athletes, you know, they do an ACL, they want to be at training sessions every week, just watching, just sitting in, making sure they're still in touch and all that. Some other athletes prefer to go away and just do all the rehab on their own.
Yeah.
And that must be a fascinating part of being working as a sports psychologist, I think.
Yeah.
Is that everybody is so different.
Everyone's so different. And that's in, like, I've started a new role, well, not new, I've been there about a year and a half now, in within the sports surgery clinic in Santry. There's a team called the Aspire Orthopedics team. So I'm part of that as part of, like, the rehabilitation of ACLs. And, you know, it's a group of knee surgeons, physios, and myself. And I suppose what they recognized was that exact thing, that, like, people with ACLs, some of them, they were getting to the end physically, everything was ticking the boxes, but they just weren't either returning when they should have or returning to full level or not returning at all to sport. And they figured out that the psychological element was the barrier, that they were saying physically they've ticked all the boxes, but yet they still don't feel confident enough for this high levels of anxiety. So it's been really interesting, I suppose, aside from the work that I do in Sport Ireland with elite athletes who have so much support wrapped around them. You have athletes who do these long-term injuries like that, you know, come home from their teams in Birmingham, have to just rehab at home away from kind of their usual support network. And some people thrive on that and they like to do it on their own and kind of take control of that. Other people, like you said, they're putting down cones on the pitch at training when they're still in their crutches because they just need to still feel part of that team. So it's been a really interesting different side of sports psychology I've been able to kind of access with kind of a, you know, a more vast population that don't always have this certain team or around them that you would have in Sport Ireland. But yeah, it's just, you know, what's really refreshing, having read through, there's just so much talk about psychology. It's great.
Right?
I mean, it's a good
day.
Yeah, I know. I was thinking that when I was reading the papers this morning.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm glad we have Jessie here to give
us
this aspect
of
it. 2025, the year of the sports psychologist.
Yeah,
there you go.
Even a piece in the Mail on Sunday as well. I think it's Philip Lanigan. No, not, is it, I think McClifford maybe does a piece with Tony O'Regan, who's a former Galway hurler.
Yeah,
and he works as a sports psychologist now, and he's actually brought out a book called MVP, Most Valuable Player, How to Unlock Your Potential. And Mark Gallagher actually has done the piece with him. Mm-hmm. And that would be of interest to people to read that as well. Because he started out working, I remember that, he started out as an accountant. And when he quit into County Hurling, he thought, do you know what, this isn't really what I want to be doing for the rest of my life. And he went back and he retrained. So it's just interesting. It's full of sports psychology in the papers today, actually.
And what's great is a lot of, you know, I'm probably sitting here as, you know, a lot of former athletes are kind of seeing that that's a route that can be taken as well now. And I think it's great to have, I suppose, a road for us.
Well, you have the lived experience as well. You know, you can relate to what a lot of people have gone through. And I think what is interesting as well about a lot of the pieces, it's almost people who maybe might not have seen the benefit or appreciated the benefit of sports psychology when they were in their sporting careers, but since then have kind of recognized that it is something that is really beneficial. And I don't know, I suppose the generations that are coming up are equipped and used to it, so it seems as normal.
Completely.
So their reception is totally different to the advice that people are giving, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah, it's been great. I mean, you know, there was a lot of the post-Paris reflections was sports that I'm already embedded in now want more access to, you know, just group workshops to the younger generations who are coming up. So you're talking the 15 to 18 development pathways, so that by the time they get to senior, they're not being referred to see a sports psychologist. And it's strange that that's been part of it right before they even reach the elite levels. So, yeah, it's definitely been seen as something that just needs to be part of the program the same way someone goes and sees a physio. Sports psychologist, you know, the education around it has just been seen as now going to be part and parcel with everything else they do, which is great.
What would you say, like, the main challenge to sports psychology in Ireland is at the moment?
There's a few, I suppose. One of the challenges, if you are a sports psychologist, I get a lot of contact from people who are training to become, or they're training to be accredited, and they're going through the accreditation process, is, I suppose, just the lack of kind of work experience opportunities at the moment. So, you know, I'll have people reaching out looking for work experience within Sport Ireland, but we just don't have the opportunities at the moment. So I suppose finding the work to make sure you get that full level of accreditation can be quite challenging. There isn't that many of us to act in supervisory roles. And then I suppose from the flip side, the challenge, if this was 4 years ago, I probably would have said that there's still a little bit of a, why do we need this attitude? That is definitely not the case anymore. If, you know, if anything, over the last year, people are reaching out and I'm actually turning down work because I just, you know, I'm finding people to, I'm referring people work all the time, because there's just not enough of us to take on the demand. So not a bad challenge to have.
But exactly.
Yeah, I think, yeah, the challenge, I suppose, now is coming down to more getting the right people in the right places and getting people trained up to the right level so that we can actually have, you know, an abundance of psychologists. We still do, but we're still a little bit behind. You know, there's still a little bit, there's not very, very clear pathways for the recent graduates to getting a role like I'm doing in Sport Ireland or Ciara Lossy or Kay Kirby. So I think that's probably more the biggest challenge. Rather than it coming from the sports side, it's more, I've now finished my master's.
Where do I go?
Kind of a direct route to become, which is, but that's probably a good challenge to have.
But I think, what I think is interesting as well is that in that openness to sports psychology, and particularly somewhere in the GA, like the GA, there's very, they don't really, it's not gendered. They don't look at the gender. They're very happy to have women come in and work on the psychology end. And we know people like Caroline Currid has worked with multiple All-Ireland winning teams.
Yeah,
Niamh Fitzpatrick, I remember being brought in with Wexford Footballers. It is interesting to me that it's never, it, gender is never a factor in that area. And that always interests me, whereas our male sports, as are they as open to bringing in female S&Cs or coaches, you know, female coaches, female managers? It's very interesting. But it is the one area where they don't seem to have, it never seems to be a problem, which is great.
Yeah, it is great. It's great sitting here as a female. So it does help. But
I also think it is funny when you, like the list of women that you had there who have all been so crucial to many, many successes, how little you actually do hear about them. You know, it's probably only in the last year or so, the likes of, you know, Caroline Kerr, that she has become a sort of household name.
Yeah.
But she was working away for ages in the background.
Yeah,
You talk to any of the people that she worked with and they will always talk, like, credit her so highly for what she did.
Yeah.
But we just don't hear about
them. No, and she's not somebody, she's always, she's
but a lot
always
of those women aren't the ones.
And a lot of sports psychologists, I think, actually, in general, keep a fairly low profile. They just like to get on with the work and
I say sitting here hello.
Which on national radio. Unusual place,
yeah, it is a different background.
You are an elite athlete as well. Yeah. That's a slightly different thing, is the, and that's where your profile came from initially. Mm. So, yeah.
But it is interesting, I suppose, you know, we have amazing sports psychologists doing amazing work, but like I'm very fortunate to work with amazing physiologists, S&C coaches, nutritionists. None of those names are known behind, you know, the Olympic medals. There was a huge team of those.
Yeah.
We are the backroom staff for a reason. We're there in the background. They're the stars. They're the people who are doing the work on in front of the cameras. We're in the back.
And male and female.
Yeah, male and female. Yeah.
But you just don't have that profile.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I went to Kate Kirby's house a couple of months ago because we did a piece with Annalise Murphy and she was talking, she was almost reticent to talk about her experiences. She's like, it's not about me, like it's about Annalise. And I was like, I know, but you were so crucial, you know, so talking about
Rio.
In Rio and the two of them living together and the little things that you wouldn't even think about that she was thinking about to make sure everything was perfect for the conditions so that Annalise could compete to the level that she wanted, as simple as, you know, just sitting around the house and watching a movie together or whatever it is.
Yep.
Things you would not think of in a elite sport setting.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what was needed in that moment. Yeah, so that's what you went for.
And you hear that and you think, is that what they're paying those sports psychologists for? To sit and watch movies? That's not what it is. But that's when you've developed the level of relationship that Kate would have had with Annalise over such a long time. There was a friendship there. There was a real, you know, there was a bond and there was such a knowledge that Kate knew what Annalise needed. And that's, I suppose, you know, the work is half it is just that relationship building. And I think maybe that could be why female sports psychologists are, you know, maybe the perception is, oh, females would be able to develop their relationships, they're talkers, they're emotional. And that's not the case. I know amazing male sports psychologists,
exactly.
But it could be why there's that openness to male teams because there's a perception of what a female can bring to probably an all-male backroom staff as well.
And
that's definitely what I've seen.
And you know, it could also be, Jessie, I always think too, it could also be that they understand that the ones who've been really successful, that it didn't matter what gender they were.
Nope.
Like I do think people like Caroline Currid broke down a lot of barriers because she has been clearly so good with so many inter-county teams in different disciplines that people went, oh, you know, it doesn't matter what gender. They're good, bring them in. Let's see what they're like.
Exactly.
Give them a chance.
Their credentials stood for themselves.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to see the inside of her brain and, you know, I feel it would give me the tools to life. I'd be able to conduct my daily life a lot better. We mentioned managers there and coaches, and there's an interesting piece in the Sunday Times with Paul Rowan talking about the setup in the Irish women's national team. So,
yeah,
Eileen Gleeson obviously was relieved from her role just before Christmas. She's still with the FAI, but that role hasn't been defined as of yet as to what it is. But one of the interesting things associated with that was that Colin Healy was also let go as part of the coaching staff. And we saw Denise O'Sullivan tweeting about how disappointed she was. Caitlin Hayes as well also commented on how disappointed she was, because I think there was a general feeling within that team that he was very, very well respected and he had an incredibly tough year. He lost his wife to cancer and came back into the team quite quickly after that. And there seems to be a sense that he thought he was going to stay on, a bit like the John O'Shea situation where he was still part of Heimer's team even though he wasn't leading the team anymore, and that, you know, Colin Healy had turned down a couple of other opportunities that came up while he was with the Irish team with the view that that's the team that he was dedicated to. So it's an interesting one.
Yeah, it's funny, I was asked, there was a meet and greet event, Katie Taylor did one out in out for Sports Direct out in Carrickmines yesterday. Was primarily a kids event for her to meet young boxers, men, boys and girls. While we were waiting for the thing to start and everything, the discussion I had with the journalist next to me was exactly about what were the FAI doing, why they haven't reappointed, why they haven't clarified what Eileen Gleeson's new role will be. It's a month since her contract finished, and I'm just surprised that they've been so slow. They're playing Nations Cup next month, aren't they?
Yeah, against Turkey.
And it just surprised
me. Are we surprised that the FAI are that slow?
But at the same time, and that was one of the questions as well, was because John O'Shea was kept on as part of the men's new package, that Colin Healy wasn't kept on, or that it wasn't clarified exactly. And from this piece, it seems clear that he let other opportunities go.
Yeah, they said at least two other opportunities.
Well, I think Cork was one mentioned as one of them, Cork City. So, I was interested at the time, and it's funny like how players' tweets do affect you, because I remember seeing Denise O'Sullivan's tweet and thinking, oh, that's interesting. If anything, I was quite surprised that more players didn't tweet about Eileen Gleeson's not being kept on. I thought that was an interesting thing as well. I think that sometimes, you know, surprises me sometimes. He makes the point here that the players have made their feelings known while stressing they don't want to try to influence the appointment of the new manager. It shows how delicate their position is. They were praised in 2017 for the strike, and then they were criticised by many when Vera Powell was removed, and that they have to also you know, thread this fine line. But at the same time, I do think that international players, whatever their gender, you know, there must be some element of trust between them and an international manager. They must develop relationships, and they should be entitled to express their opinions. And I'm often surprised that they don't express them more often.
Well, I suppose it's kind of like Jesse was saying earlier in terms of the sports psychology side of like admitting any sort of weakness. When you do speak up in a lot of different contexts, you do worry that that's going to put a mark beside your name. And I suppose Denise is probably one of the few in the squad
who's so well established.
You couldn't drop her.
There would not be a hope that would happen. But at the same time, I don't think that an expression of gratitude after a manager has left is anything that should be a black mark against your name.
Like, that's true.
I think there's that element to it. But the discussion we were having yesterday was that we just felt, we were both chatting about this because I was saying, like, we've just lost Niamh Fahey. She's just retired. There is an age demographic in that team where you reckon you're going to lose a player or two in the next 2 years. Eileen Gleeson probably knows a lot of the underage players more than most. Can she have a role in helping us to bring through the next gen? Because that's where we are now with this team. So it just seems to me that I wouldn't believe in any hiatus. Whatever the FAI's history is, they should be getting on this fairly quickly.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that whole role of women and girls football, we haven't really heard that much from that department.
No,
the
and
last
she's
year
technically been replaced, hasn't she?
Yeah, exactly. Hannah Digby is in there now. I know she did, there was one particular course that they ran, and she was speaking at that, and it was to do with SMC and coaching and that side of things. But apart from that, I've seen very little from her over the last year. And this is one thing that's frustrated me when it comes to the football team since the World Cup, is that I felt like there was a brilliant opportunity there to capitalize. And I know the FAI will say that there are, I can't remember what the figure is, but there has been an increase in girls playing football, which is brilliant. But in terms of actually cementing them in the public consciousness, I don't think that's really happened, and it's been quite disappointing. And now we're not going to have that because we haven't qualified for the Euros.
Yeah.
So there seems to be a real fear that any progress that has been made is just going to melt away a little bit.
Yeah, I kind of felt, though, that there was a little bit of an overreaction almost to the to not qualifying for the Euros and the Welsh when I was at it. I have a season ticket for the Irish women's team. I believe in when you support women's sport, you pay money, you know, and you go and you're at the games. And something that really interested me that night, I got a late train home to, I live in Kildare, and I noticed that there was a really late train to Cork.
Yeah.
And there was a special train on that night from Cork.
Mm.
And I know people will say, oh, there's a fear that we lose momentum. And obviously, we also have a situation now where Irish players going to England now are competing against the best in the world to try and get into teams, which the previous generation didn't really have, Kathleen, I think.
Yeah.
And this is really pushing them to their limit. But it can also make them learn to the limit. But I thought it was interesting, like that would never have happened before. And people saying, oh, we're going to go back now. I don't think so. I think that there's an established support there amongst a certain amount of football followers in the country that I don't think is going to wane, even though they didn't make the Euros. Because it doesn't wane in other sports. You know, I think they have been established, I think, in the public thing. Yes, you want them to be at every major championship they can be at. And when you qualify for World Cup, obviously you want to go to the next Euros and you want to keep that momentum going. But I do think that there has been progress made, and in terms of visibility and awareness, I think that it's there. I just hope that the FAI get on it fast now and start developing the next gen, you know, to the highest level that they need to be at as quickly as possible.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see who they do get in, because you would say, in an Irish context, there are very few names that I can think of that would have the capacity to take on a role like that. And then at an international level, it's how much money is actually there to give someone if they do come in. You look at the example of Northern Ireland and then bringing in Tanya Oxtoby. That's exactly the sort of ambition
that should be there.
Yeah. And it remains to be seen whether it is or not. But it'll be.
And we also have to say, it's unprecedented that an Irish men's team in any sport is got a sponsorship because the women's team had the sponsorship.
Yeah.
Like, that's unprecedented.
Yeah.
So, like, I know that there, people will feel not making the Euros, you know, there is a potential there for things to go backwards. But I actually think that things have got to a point now where they're in a great place to move forward. It just, the right people need to be appointed and the right players need to be developed.
Well, they must be fairly confident that they're going to get someone in the next month, because there's no interim set up there.
No, that's what's strange. That's what's really strange, I think. And that's why I think the players, even if maybe Colin Healy had been kept on the interim, maybe that would have been a solution. I don't know, but it wasn't done.
Yeah.
It does seem to have left a big vacuum there.
Yeah, it's an interesting one.
But it's good to see it in the papers. It's good to see it being discussed, because it's what football supporters are talking about, and it's what journalists are talking about as well. And it's great to see that.
Definitely, we've a special episode of Koi Gig coming up during the week with Leo O'Leary on her big move to Bristol City.
Great.
So for any football fans, keep an eye out for that one. One of the other things that I spotted in the papers, which I found quite interesting, was the issue of referees and the lack of referees. And it's kind of, there's a big focus on GA in particular, looking at the new rules and the fact that those are making referees a little reluctant to sign on for the new season because there is so much more that they have to look out for. And also the fact that at an inter-county level, you obviously have a massive team of people behind you and supporting you, but at the lower levels, you don't have that, and it can often just be one person with no umpire, no linesman, nothing to assist. And then we also have the issue of the abuse that referees get, and that kind of bleeds into the rugby as well, and everything this week with Chris Busby after the Mac Hansen comments and his ban for three matches But I thought the GA one was particularly interesting, that say some counties reporting that people were signing on and saying that they would still do women's football, they still do camogie, they still do hurling, but they didn't want to do the men's football because of the new rules.
Wait, actually, and specificallyin this case, it's Wicklow. McClifford in the Mail on Sunday has a piece on this. And I'm sure it'd be very interesting if somebody did it granularly on every county, but in this case, in Wicklow, 7 referees have said that they won't do men's football. They're still fine with the other disciplines, but actually men's football, and obviously the presumption has to be that this is linked into the new rules and the difficulty of refereeing the new rules at club level. And how are you going to do that? Because you, as you say, you don't have the same amount of personnel. If you're struggling to get a referee for a club game, now you're looking to get referees who can referee these new rules, maybe even on pitches that aren't properly marked. I don't know, like at every level. And the Wicklow County Chairman, Damien Byrne, says, like, most of their referees, he says, are over 50 years of age. It's very hard to recruit new referees. And now these new rules, the implication of the new football rules are clearly that the game is going to be faster. You know, that the ball is going to move quicker, that the game is going to be faster. And that's referees a challenge for referees as well.
Sure.
You know, so there's a good piece on it. Like, actually, Mick does a great summary on the new rules in one paragraph.
He does,
doesn't he? It's brilliant. He says a 50-metre penalty for unsporting cynical play, a 40-metre arc from which all kickouts must be clear and which also serves as the borderline that doubles as the value of a kick point, and the policy of an offside rule, which is effective with the 3-up, 3-back is. There are the headline changes. And actually, we've all been reading about the changes, but actually that's a perfect summary of it. And he has a brilliant line, and he says, he's the one who's saying about it. Yeah, he said, a raft of radical new rules have landed on their desk, and unlike their far better resource inter-county colleagues, club referees might be forgiven for thinking they're a bit like a sheriff without a deputy in a wild west town hosting a gun-toting hooli. And it's pretty much a really good summary of it. But you can see why it is going to create challenges for referees, and in a sport, and Shane McGrath touches on it in his column this week as well, in a sport where referees already take an awful lot of abuse, this is definitely going to challenge them. And it's something that the Football Review Committee, all the notions are all brilliant. The effort to speed up the game is brilliant. But at club level is often where the real testing point comes for the GA. And the insistence always that whatever we do at inter-county level must apply at club level. And there was a motion to the Special Congress in November, which I think was that they'd give it a year at inter-county level before they'd introduce it at club level. Mm. But I think that wasn't agreed upon. And maybe that might have been the best option.
Yeah, well, it would at least give referees the opportunity to watch how it's done at that high level, get a feel for things instead of what the situation is at the moment, which it feels a little bit like sending them in blind to deal with stuff. And especially when they're already being asked to do so much. I know they were talking as well about the lack of referees in general, particularly in Dublin, which has
Dublin
the biggest population in the country. And I think they have something like 154 officials, but there's on average 136 games a week.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's not leaving you a lot of room for rest or,
And they've come out recently, and that's before you go into underage games and college games and everything else. And Dublin have recently come out strongly and said they have an issue recruiting referees. And as you said, that's the county in some ways that has less logistical problems for referees, you know, getting to games, you know, organising games, all that kind of stuff.
You have some sort of a public transport system compared to if you're in the countryside.
Yeah, so it's interesting that it's being spoken of, because I think it is kind of one of the, you know, untested areas that the FRC, you know, you can have your math games or whatever. You can try out things. We haven't seen it even operating at inter-county level. But what are the implications for referees at a club level is a big one.
It feels like an area in general that we need to look at in the country. You know, we talked about the fact that there's so many games that we don't have enough referees for, introduction of new rules, the way referees are treated. I think that whole conversation this week in the rugby context has been particularly interesting, because there's been two very different sides, and Stuart Burns has written a piece on it as well today. David Walsh. And saying that, you know, where a lot of people were probably annoyed about the Mac Hansen ban and the wording of the ban, and the effects was a little bit patronizing, I think people would have said, but they were kind of pointing out where is the outrage for the likes of Busby and the amount of abuse that they get online. And we don't really have that same feeling towards referees weird way.
No. Roy Keane in the Mail on Sunday has a very good little column, just an opinion column. And he's so right, because I was watching the matches yesterday and I'm thinking, bloody hell, they're introducing new rules, a change in the rules during major competitions in rugby. I mean, if you did that in the GAA, people would be up and they'd be hell, and everybody saying, oh, that's the GAA, they're inefficient. But actually, this is operating at world rugby level, and you're thinking, what the hell? How can you expect a referee to be perfect, which we all do, and of course they're not, just like players, and you're throwing new rules at them mid-season in really important competitions? And Roy Keane says there's a ledger of laws which would, in rugby, he said, which would give War and Peace a run for its money, such as its length and density. And he's right. Like, it seems to me that rugby, for safety reasons and all the rest, rugby rules are becoming more and more complicated. They brought in new rules at the start of the season. They're bringing in new rules mid-season. And he's saying the same thing. He says, Busby's quite right. This is the referee who we think is going to...
Murray Kinsella reported during the week that he was set to retire. Yeah. Now, there was no specific linking to everything that happened with Mac Hansen, but I suppose the timing would lead you to think that. Perhaps.
Yeah, and the headline on Roy Keane's piece is Busby's quite right to get off this toxic treadmill, because he's saying referees are forever getting it in the neck in rugby from head coaches in the background. I think in GAA we see it more obviously in the foreground. You see it on the pitch. Yeah. Really, you shouldn't be seeing. But I've even noticed, even in interprovincial rugby, you know, it was always like the captain talks. Even last night watching Leinster, it wasn't always the captain who was putting a question in the referee's ear, or Munster last night. And I'm thinking, you know, they're definitely under more pressure, rugby referees. Mm-hmm. And actually, it's worth reading for anybody who's interested in this, David Walsh's piece on the back of the Sunday Times, because he goes through that Connacht match, a Leinster match, And he actually looks at the details of it. Like, Mac Hansen is a really likeable guy. Mm-hmm. He's a really straight up guy. He's a very entertaining guy. And everybody kind of accepted, a lot of people accepted what he said as, you know, being gospel and, as you know, all poor old Connacht are always getting in the neck. But David Walsh re-looked at it and he says, Leinster were penalised 15 times, Connacht 14. Leinster got 2 yellow cards, Connacht 1. And Hansen was citing the Geordie Barrett shoulder and Bundiaki. And he says, at the time, Premier Sports commentator and former Ireland international Alan Quinlan said, I think he, Aki, might have been playing it a bit. So, like, you know, sometimes I think we're swayed by our opinions of personalities as well. Yeah. And Hansen is a very likeable guy. And he probably expressed the frustration that Connacht fans have. How the international community or the competition have reacted to him and send him off on trainee, you know, nonsense, this kind of stuff. That really irritates people as well. They're going, oh, for God's sake, let them have an opinion. Mm. But at the same time, David Walsh's piece and Roy Keane's piece, as well as who speaks up for the referees?
Mm. Yeah. Did you ever come across referees in your line of work?
Yeah, I was always interested in that.
Not really, no. Yeah. No. But there is a lot of research. It's interesting that this is what's kind of coming to the fore now, because there is research being done, I think it's mainly through Ulster University, on, I suppose, mental health of referees. And a lot of it is stemming from the treatment. And I suppose they're kind of the last in line to get those supports. Like, they, you know, we talk about the supports we're given to athletes and players for what they're exposed to on social media. But the, you know, the referees are getting torn apart. And like that, they're...
If I was a referee, I would not be on social
media. No. And then would you want to, you know, referee a club game or an underage game where you also have parents involved getting in the ear, dealing with new rules, like, you know, all the uncertainty of, like, having to know and be always up on these rules. They're meant to be, you know, they're held to a different standard.
Yeah.
But then where is the support for them? So the research that's coming out is really interesting. I think there's more going to be done with referees as the focus, because they've recognised that the abuse is only getting more as social media becomes more important, and they don't have a place to hide. There is nowhere to hide. There isn't that kind of, you know, there's probably, I know there's some sort of unions and stuff, but I mean, what are they accessing? You know, they're, you know, their families are probably involved.
A lot of them would talk about being very reliant on each other, like other referees.
Yeah.
Especially if you're at a team. Tournament. Yeah. Say like Six Nations or a World Cup or something, because you're spending a lot of time and you're probably living in similar quarters.
You have time with your colleagues. Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's interesting. One of my favorite refereeing stories always was an NBA story where, you know, one of the best referees was challenged one day by a player and he turned around to him and he said, "Did you mean to miss that three-pointer there?" But I think in an environment and a world that is increasingly has feelings of entitlement and also this demand for perfection through social media, everybody has to be right and everything must be perfect all the time.
But everyone also has a platform to share that opinion as well.
Exactly. That makes it life so much harder for referees because I think they're being challenged more all the time. And I always thought that was the best reply I'd ever heard because players make mistakes all the time in games. And no referee is ever going to be perfect. And I know, okay, obviously a TMO, you expect them. But even still, you look now, you know, at the variations on, you know, how high was head high? You know, was it accidental? Was it not? Mm-hmm. Like it is becoming more and more difficult, even though you have technology trying to help it.
Yeah, you know? Well, you're asking people to judge someone else's intentions without having any conversation
about
it. Watching
in a split second.
In a split second, watching it slowed down as well.
Yeah.
Try to read their face, be like, did they mean that? Head high tackle.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's a great way to put it. Yeah. So it is, but I think the world is like now more and more demanding of it. You know, everybody has to be brilliant at everything and everybody has to be right about everything. Mm-hmm. And I'm always right about everything. And life is just grey. It's not black and white. So I thought it was interesting that even though there was so much support for Matt Canson in the wake of that, and for certain elements of it, I could see why. It is interesting that two people are there saying, "Well, what about the referees and who's supporting the referees?"
I don't think people put two and two together with those things. I think anyone who was saying Matt Canson was right and we agree with his comments wasn't thinking of the flurry of abuse that would probably come down on Chris Busby's head, or because I think referees, when they're in the game anyways, they're not really that public facing in terms of, you know, they're not doing interviews. They're probably not tweeting about things. Yeah. So you're not seeing it in the same way that you might with a player who could put something up and then you'll see all the replies to it. And you're like, oh, they're getting a lot of abuse or whatever.
And Busby isn't that experienced either, Kathleen. Like he's only 38. The notion that he would, if it is confirmed that he's retiring, will raise serious questions.
He only had his first test match last year.
So it'd be really interesting if he does, if it happens and if he comes out and speaks about it, it would be very educational, I think, for everybody.
Yeah.
Like it's interesting looking at the way referees are spoken about this, like it is depersonalization. Yeah. You kind of forget that there's a person behind the rule keeper. You know, with everyone else, you know, there's uniforms, but we all know the players, even though they're there just in their numbered jerseys in rugby. We still know who they are. But there's something with the refs that we know who their names, but like there is kind of like we just have an expectation or they're robotic. You kind of forget there's a person, the way maybe athletes might have been seen at a point. And I think, you know, we're talking so much about sports psychology and like the mental side of the game. And we're recognizing that like that players make mistakes. Athletes are human. I feel refs haven't been given that grace yet because we don't see them. We see them as a cog in the machine of the game as opposed to a person who actually has just an involvement and can make mistakes. So it's, I don't know what's going to change if that research that does come out. Will there be, you know, a change in attitude? It's a more difficult one because they're not for anyone in particular. You know, it's very hard to support, you know, if you're a fan, it's very hard to be in support of the referee because they probably made a mistake against your team. Yeah. You know, and so rugby, it's a difficult one.
I think rugby referees as well, like I've always thought it's the strangest job because unlike most referees, they have license to say, don't foul there, you're going to foul there, stop.
Yeah.
Which is really
They can odd, actually kind of help you out.
Which is really odd that you have
they're on your side.
Who tells you, watch out there, you're going to foul. But the reason for that is a safety thing. I could never get my head around it until I spoke to a few referees, rugby referees, and Joy Neville was one of them. And she was like, yeah, but it's a, there's a big safety issue here. Mm. So you're refereeing with safety of the players in mind always ahead of that. And yet, as you say, we still see them as, a lot of people still see them as the enemy, you know, as the ones who are trying to put this discipline on them.
Yeah.
Whereas you could look at them in a completely different light. And it's a very difficult, it's a difficult tightrope to straddle, I think.
Yeah. I think as well, people think that referees just rock up and that they don't spend immense amount of times training. Like, they have to be as fit as the players to keep up. And I remember talking to Michelle O'Neill about it and the training camps that she would go into before major tournaments, where they would, you know, sit for hours reviewing tapes and all the training that goes into it. It's not just, you know, you rock up to a game every weekend and through learned experience, you know what's going on. You know, it's their job. They put a lot of work into their fitness, into their diet.
Yeah.
It's
They're training like athletes.
Yeah, it's grueling. I always remember my very limited sporting career. I was a eager participant of the bench a lot of the time. I loved it, but I wasn't very good. And I always said I wanted to be a referee because I loved rules and I loved, you know, I always thought as a way that I could be in sport, but be good at it because I was never a hand-eye coordination, not one of my strong points at all. And people's reactions to that always baffled me. They were like, but why? Why would you want to do that? Yeah. And I was going to it as like a kid, really eager, just wanting to do something. And it was always, you're almost pushed back on, and it happened so constantly that I never actually pursued it in any sort of way. Yes, right. And it wasn't even about the abuse you might get or any. It was just people were genuinely confused at the idea of
why you want to be a referee.
I know.
Kind of tells you all that you need to know about the attitudes towards a ref. It seems it's just a thankless job that someone has to do.
We're nearly out of time, but there's a few other good pieces that you highlighted, Cliona. There's a really interesting interview with Cyrus Christie. Philip Quinn also has a good one on Ireland's connection with Everton. You could even say Sligo's connection with Everton.
Yeah, it's a really good piece, actually. Everton fans would love that.
And also Mark Gallagher on Irish darts nurseries, which I found that one really interesting.
Yeah, in the Mail on Sunday, it's really good. As we always say, Mark always comes at, has a great eye for what we call less popular sports. But in this case, obviously, it's the Luke Littler effect. But it's actually a really interesting piece on not only the fact that this happened. So in Naoimh Fionnbar GAA Club in Cabra now, every Monday night they have a D7 darts academy, and they've already got 60 kids. It only started last June, right? 60 kids between the age of 8 and 17. But what's really interesting is, and there's more of these springing up around the country, so parents might be interested in this, they're tied into the JDC, and the JDC is the Junior Darts Corporation, and they're the youth wing of the PDC, which of course runs the Ali Pally. And all your results, this is the modern technology, all your results, if you're a member of this little one in Cabra, the D7, they are registered, their scoring is registered into the English system, right? And there's a chance through that to secure an invitation to the JDC World Junior Championships. And last year, several young Irish players, including three from the Hornets Academy in Tala, took part in that event in Gibraltar. So there's a little link there.
Yeah.
And it could really be the start of something really interesting. And they're looking to develop more of these junior darts academies around the country. So I just think it's a really interesting one.
Yeah.
And if you've got a kid who's already shown a talent for it, absolutely, check it out and have a look. And I'd say you're going to get, they've only opened their doors. He was talking about another club who'd only just opened their doors, but in Craig Kieran. It's funny, actually, GAA clubs have, you know, they have the infrastructure there to be able to go in and set one up in it.
Yeah.
And but how it could link to the international thing is really interesting and lead to international opportunities is brilliant.
Yeah, so I picked that one out as one of my favourite stories, because I suppose after the summer, you know, we had so much talk of, like, say, the relay team inspiring young girls and the ribbons. I said, you know, there's so many of the sports that we see all the time that a lot are maybe seen as inaccessible unless you are quite sporty anyway. I mean, talk about a sport that could be more accessible to someone who doesn't see themselves as sporty, as a kid who maybe just doesn't think sport is for them, or team sports or running. I mean, I just love the idea of someone like Luke Littler being an inspiration for a next generation of really, and
for his own untapped generation kind of as well.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Not that much younger, but just like that untapped area. And I saw that with the two guys in badminton. It's not a sport you would know loads about, but I feel badminton is really, it has always been there, but I feel it's on the fore. So I just love when you have a story like that, that someone like him, who's a really unexpected hero to, you know, to kind of, and actually that's my local GAA club. So
There you go.
I think I'm a bit old, but.
Oh, you never know. I actually ran into a friend yesterday evening, and he's 29, And just in the last year, took up badminton because of the
because of the guys.
Because of the
and
guys.
Seeing, and just seeing it, that
and
it's,
loves it.
It's something that's accessible and that's an option.
Yeah, and now travels all around the country, has gone abroad for tournaments. And again, brilliant. Would have said, he was like, I would have run a little bit, but never would have counted himself as a particularly sporty person.
Yeah.
Would be far more of the artistic
yeah.
side of things, but just loves it and is totally inspired
found
by
his
it.
Niche.
Yeah,
found
exactly.
His sport.
We actually had Linda Maher on around just before the final of the darts, and she has a couple of kids in her family who are all competing in that club in Cabra, and she said it's absolutely brilliant every evening.
Fantastic. It's fantastic.
You go down
idea.
And
love it.
Everyone's
so many kids involved.
Yeah.
And that
yeah.
team sport element of them, as you were saying before about the encouragement, the support, you know, the network they create, even at that age.
Yeah.
Whatever sport it is, it's fantastic.
Brilliant.
Yeah. No, it is. It's brilliant. And I think it'd be great to see that happening more and more. It's kind of a bit of a full circle moment, but going back to the rowing that we were talking about
yeah.
at the start, you know, because we have those characters in Irish rowing now, it's seen as a sport that was probably a minority sport for a long time. It's now seen as much more accessible.
Yeah.
Like I know Sligo Rowing Club in particular saw a massive uptick in the people that were coming to them
yeah.
over the last couple of years. So it's brilliant and long may it continue. I'm excited to see what the next big sport will be.
Mm.
Paddle kind of took off a little bit.
Paddle,
in 2024.
Did. Definitely
yeah.
are too. And again, they're seen as more accessible forms or not as challenging maybe physically as tennis, and they're a way in for people. And
yeah.
paddle is really exploding as well.
Yeah.
Speaking of accessibility, there is one I'd like to bring to people's attention before we finish.
Yep.
Eamon Sweeney, who's always good. And the papers today are full of a debate about, obviously, about the Rory Gallagher, you know, possibly going to NACE, so people can read them because there's a multitude, and it just shows
a lot
how
of
divisive
different.
This issue is because
yeah.
there are so polarised, the opinions of this are so polarised, but some really good pieces. Dermot Crowe has a very good background
sides of
piece
it in the papers.
But Eamon Sweeney has pieces as well, but he has a piece as well about cricket and the Taliban and Afghanistan. And like, I just cannot understand how there isn't more controversy and more opposition to Afghanistan playing international sport at the moment, giving their treatment of women. Anybody who follows Christine Lam, who's just a brilliant foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times, she did an interview this week with Irish Radio, and like I think at one point she said, in Afghanistan they reckon that if the ultimate will be when they say there isn't enough oxygen, so women have to stop breathing because now they can't be seen at their windows, they can't be seen conversing with other women. They haven't since 2021 been allowed to go to secondary school. Every possible just rule against freedom is there, and yet Afghanistan can compete in international sport, and Ireland played, as he points, Ireland played Afghanistan 6 times last year without a whimper of protest.
Mm.
And in my opinion, they should be banned from international sport.
Well, we very much choose the causes that we want to punish people for, don't we? We see it in a multitude of different areas in international sport at the moment. You know, if it's Russia, it's very different to if it's Israel or, as you say, Afghanistan. We don't seem to want to examine these things too closely.
Yeah.
They're easier ones to ban rather than the harder ones that kind of make you have
yeah.
to look inward a little bit.
Yeah, I just, it's one that really shocks me at the moment. Just given, you know, the increase, you know, the way women are treated in Afghanistan since 2021 is just inhuman.
Yeah, it's
and,
shocking.
You know, I think personally I wouldn't have Israel being allowed to compete in international sport at the moment. And I definitely wouldn't have Afghanistan. But as you say, people pick their battles.
Yeah.
And battles can be very political at times.
They definitely can.
But I'm glad Eamon Sweeney's raised it.
Yeah, it's a really interesting piece and definitely one to look at. Thank you both very much for coming in. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
I hope you have a good week and enjoy the rest of your Sundays. And we will be back very shortly.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
I honestly think psychologically there's a bit of a mess there, and I think it comes from before what we're talking about with Real Madrid.
Join in the obsession.
Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.